We have to start because you are on time and we will not let you wait. And those people who will come late, they will miss the introduction. Welcome to this lecture. You've been welcomed by a checkpoint, basically, and you've been asked for your identity card. And I heard that some people felt a little bit uncomfortable. Of course, we did that on purpose so that you can have a little bit an idea of what Palestinians go through nearly every day. We have invited our Palestinian friends who are on the front row, Yasmin Rishmawi and Ramzi Koumsiyeh, and Niall, who is in the back. He's still checking the door. Stay guard. Don't let the terrorists in. They have come to share with us some personal experiences of life under occupation, and in the same time to share with us what can we do to help the Palestinian cause for justice. We want to make very clear that we are not, as an organization, I work for the Olive Tree Campaign, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it. We are not pro-Palestinian or anti-Israel. We're absolutely not anti-Semites or anti-Jews, which is sometimes something that people throw at our faces. We are pro-justice, and we are in favor of implementation of international laws. And that's something that I want to make clear from the beginning. I work for an organization called the Olive Tree Campaign. What we do is we plant olive trees in the West Bank and in Gaza, at places where the Israeli army is uprooting trees in order to build the separation wall or where they are expanding settlements. We ask people in the West to sponsor a tree, and then we go there every year in February and we plant the trees. This is a sign of hope for a better future. It is also a way of non-violent resistance to show that we are not giving up our land. And in the same time, we use this campaign for what we call in English advocacy work, which means going around to schools, to public meetings, to churches and mosques to tell about the situation in Palestine. Because unfortunately, we very often get the Israeli point of view, and much less do we get the true Palestinian point of view. We do also get some Palestinian point of view, but through the media it's somehow very distorted. So this week we have been traveling around with Yasmin to different schools where we have been giving talks. And basically we decided that we're going to do something a little bit similar and then also different, because we do expect people who come to Appelscha to have some sort of active attitude, which means that after you have seen our presentation, you might want to get involved somehow. So we also want to give you the tools of how you can get involved with this cause and how you can do that in a more practical way. So the presentation will consist of three parts. I'm going to give you a brief introduction of the history of that area for those people who say, I kind of know, but I kind of forgot what is happening in Israel and Palestine. And since I'm a qualified history teacher, I think that I'm qualified to tell you that. Then we're going to listen to some of the personal experiences from Yasmin, Ramzi, and Niall. And after that, we're going to tell you a little bit more about campaigns that are going on and that you may want to join. When we started, I'm using the same presentation as I used in the schools, because I thought, you know, I already have it, and actually I think it's a pretty good presentation that's useful. And in the schools I start with this map, because some people even forget where the area is that we're talking about. I didn't expect that you wouldn't know, but you know, to set your mind. Also to see that if I go to that area, I've lived there for a year and a half, and I keep going back. And when I go on the airport in Schiphol, Amsterdam, and I fly, if I have a direct flight, 4.5 hours, and then I land in Tel Aviv airport. Tel Aviv, you can see it on the left, it's on the coast. The area that is purple is what is called Israel. Then the yellow areas, the Gaza Strip, the small part on the left, the bigger part on the right is the West Bank, and then up in the north, the Golan Heights. So the yellow areas are the areas that are occupied by the Israeli army. And then you can see that the neighboring countries are Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. For example, when Yasmin came here last Sunday, She lives in Bethlehem. You can see that it's in the West Bank. She lives very close from the airport. It would be a 40-minute drive by car, but she's not allowed to go through the airport because she's not allowed to go into Israel. There is a big wall and a lot of checkpoints that separate her from that region. That means that she has to fly through Amman. And if you want to go to Jordan, you do not only cross just easily from the West Bank into Jordan, you first have to pass the Palestinian border. Then there is an Israeli border, even you won't really see it on this map. And then you have to cross the Jordanian border. So it took you 15 hours. And she told me this is the quickest time that I ever went when I went to Europe, because usually it can take up to 30 hours before I can actually cross all these borders and checkpoints. Some people wonder, why do they call it the West Bank? What's the reason for calling it the West Bank? Well, the border between the West Bank and Jordan is the Jordan River. There is a river actually there. And this is the West Bank of the Jordan River. That's why we call it the West Bank. And I'm going to tell you a little bit of a personal experience before I go into the history. I went to Israel and Palestine for the first time in 2006. First I was in Israel only, and I traveled around and I wanted to visit also the West Bank, but people were telling me that it was dangerous and that I shouldn't go there. So I basically didn't. I was visiting also the Anarchists Against the Wall, which is an Israeli group of anarchists that are protesting the occupation. But they told me that maybe it's better if I don't go, or at least not on my own. Now I think that, I've lived alone in the West Bank for a year and a half after that, and I think it's pretty safe for me to be there. But in that time I was scared. I went back to Holland and I checked the internet, and then I said, I have to go and see with my own eyes, and also to hear the story from the other side, from, let's say, behind the wall. And I found this organization that is the organization I work for now, that went every October with a group of foreigners to help with the olive harvest. In October is the month where the olives are being harvested. And it's not that Palestinian farmers can't harvest their own olives and that we have to help them as some sort of like cheap labor. It is because during the olive harvest, a lot of Palestinian farmers are being attacked by either Israeli soldiers or very radical Jewish settlers, we call them settlers or colonists. So in my first trip, we were with a group of, I think, 30 people, and we went to several villages. And actually, on the first day, we were encountered by a group of Jewish settlers who approached us in their normal outfits. So they were not military, but they were all wearing big guns, and they were very threatening. One of them was throwing stones at us, and one of them was shouting at us that we were Nazis because we were helping the Palestinians. So we told him that we are not against Jewish people, that we are against the occupation of the land, and that we are just supporting the Palestinian farmer. In this case, fortunately, that the military showed up and was kind of a standoff between the our group and the settlers. But this was the image that struck me. There was a Jewish settler, you can see him on the left, the man who's wearing the kippah, and he was saying, this is our land because we are the chosen people and this land was promised to us. And he was holding up the Torah and saying that, this is for us. On the other hand, there was a Palestinian farmer who was saying, well, we bought this land. The grandparents of my grandparents have a document that proves that we bought this land. So we've been working here for over the past 100 years. So this is our land. And that was when it struck me, and I thought I have to stay here longer in order to really understand the situation. I'm going to take you back into history 2,000 years, and I'm going to do it very briefly, so don't worry. It's not going to be a very long lecture. But I have to mention a few things. If we go back in history 2,000 years ago, then the area we're talking about was under the Roman occupation or the Roman Empire. And in that time, there was a large Jewish community who lived in what was not called Israel at that time, but was referred to as Judea and Samaria. And during the revolt their revolt against the Roman Empire. There was a lot of violence from the Roman side, and a lot of Jewish people fled the area. This is what we call the Jewish diaspora. This is why we find so many Jewish people living all over the world. These people were not often treated in a very nice way. So they came to Europe, they came to the northern part of Africa, they were in Arab countries. And in many occasions, especially in Europe, there was anti-Semitism. So the Jewish people suffered from not being welcomed, not being able to have all kinds of jobs. We all know that it resulted in the Second World War, in the Holocaust, where 6 million Jews died, and also a lot of other people, gypsies, political activists, and so on. This is something that we should keep in mind. The movement that we call the Zionist movement, which was a movement starting in the middle of the 19th century, started to think of the Jewish people as one people, maybe not so much even related to the religion, but in Judaism now it's like if your mother is Jewish, then you are also automatically Jewish. It doesn't mean that you have to be a believer, but you are automatically Jewish. And they said, we would like to have a country for ourselves, a country where we can have, and this is what is, you can find that anywhere, what Zionism means, a country where we will have a Jewish majority and where the Jewish people will rule, where they will be the boss and where there will be a Jewish majority. So they started to look for a place where that could happen, and they have thought, for example, about Argentina. They thought about countries in the northern part of Africa, and they thought about Palestine. And in that time, the area there was called Palestine. They sent a group of people to check the region, and they came back and they said, the bride is beautiful, but she's already married, which meant it's a beautiful area, but there are already people living there. So the myth that we learned that this was a land without people, for a people without land, is not true, even according to the first Zionist of the Zionist movement. We also have to remember that many Zionists said we're returning to where we were originally from, which is the area that they came from during the Roman Empire. But many things have happened in the 2000 years. There was an Ottoman occupation, and there were, if you go to Palestine now and you see the population of the Palestinians, you will find people with very white skin and blue eyes to very dark skin and very, very dark hair, because this area, people have lived and came from all over the world. So there was the Turkish occupation, and then later we had the British. I mean, before even we had the Crusaders, people from Armenia, from Assyria that were refugees, arrived in that region. So it's a region where a lot of different kinds of people have lived over the centuries. If we look at around, I'm jumping now in time, so don't worry, we're going quickly, around 1900, then in that time 10% of the population was Jewish, 90% of the population was Palestinians, 90% of those were Muslim, and 10% was Christian. There are a lot of people who do not realize that there is a Christian community, especially around Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, so it's quite kind of logic. Actually, the Palestinians that we have in our midst now are from Christian families. So just so that you know. It's not so important for you, I know, but you know. If we look at this map, then we can see what happened over the past 63, 64 years. The first map shows all the green areas were owned by Palestinian farmers, and the white areas were owned by the Jewish people who lived in that region and who were referred to as Jewish Palestinians because they were inhabitants of Palestine. And then you can see that over the next decades, the Palestinians have lost a lot of their land. Until the last photo or picture that you can see, that the areas where Palestinians are now allowed to live in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip are shrank into sort of, yeah, we can refer it as Bantustans or ghettos, areas that are completely, could completely be sealed off from the surroundings. How did that happen? I told you about Zionism. They chose Palestine to go and live there. And then since 1880 until just after the Second World War, more and more Jewish immigrants came to Palestine. And those were immigrants from Europe, from North Africa, from Arab countries. And they started to live in Palestine. And in the beginning, it was not a big deal. In the beginning, the people would be living together. There would be Palestinians who would be working for Jewish families, for example. Like I know an older person who said that, yeah, I used to work for a Jewish family and I was the babysitter and I was teaching them Arabic language and they were teaching me the Hebrew language. But then when more and more Jewish immigrants came and it became clear that the ideology of Zionism was to have a majority over the inhabitants who were already living there, that's when the problem started. Then the United Nations said, these people are not going to live together in a nice way because there was lots of riots and there was starting to be violence. And they said, we will divide the country. We will give the Jewish people the orange part and then the purple part will go to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians said, no, because you're giving our land away to new immigrants. Where are we going to live? The people who came, for example, from Jaffa or from Haifa said that now it's going to be Israel. Then what's going to happen with us? Do we have to move away? Are they going to treat us equally? They're also giving the new immigrants more land than to us, who are the native inhabitants. So they disagreed. They said, we do not accept this plan by the United Nations. And then David Ben-Gurion, the leader of the Zionist movement, said, okay, then we will start our country unilateral. We will just declare our country. And in 1948, on the 15th of, or the 14th of May, they declared the State of Israel. Now, what happened in that time is something that we never learned in school. I wonder if any of you heard this story at history in school. I've learned it later by reading and studying, and actually I learned it by studying an Israeli historian who went into the archives of the military and opened up the files, which were opened up 50 years after this time, so that's about 10 years ago. And he wrote what he found, wrote down what he found. And what he found was this, that in 1948, in order to create the State of Israel with a Jewish majority, 531 Palestinian villages were wiped off the map. So it was the creation of the State of Israel that wiped Palestine off the map. All the black dots that you see here were villages where people lived, where people had their farms, where people were getting married, where they were having a normal life. Some of them were even cities with a real city life, with theaters and with shops and schools and everything. And what happened, and this is very well documented, is that in a plan called Plan Dalet, it was described that the Jewish militias should enter the villages from three sides, throw some bombs, shoot, do some shooting so that the Palestinian inhabitants will be afraid, and then they would run away. Most of them closed their houses with their key, and until today they still have the old keys to their houses. They fled to the only opening that they left of the village, which was in the north to Lebanon, and in the east towards Syria, and people fled into the West Bank and into the Gaza Strip. And then the biggest refugee problem that still exists today started. And on this map, you can see that all the circles are refugee camps. And if you just take a look on the down on the left, where is the Gaza Strip, you can see that the Gaza Strip, which is as big as almost Texel and Terschelling, the two islands together, there are more than 1.5 million people who live there. More than 1 million of them is refugee, which means they are not or even originally from there. They are from the villages around. The whole refugee problem in the Gaza Strip could be solved in half an hour. If there were enough buses, all the people, all the refugees could be brought back to their villages. Because what happened is that most of these villages were destroyed. The Jewish National Fund planted trees, forests, and there is still space now for these refugees to return. But Israel has never allowed the refugees to come back. So we have a refugee problem since 60 years. In the beginning, the people used to live in tents, obviously. And this is a photo from 1950. It was taken in Jordan. And I'm going to show you a photo of the exact same location, but this photo was taken a year ago. the people are still living in a refugee camp. Obviously, they are not living in tents anymore. People do not live for 60 years in tents. They started building houses all on top of each other because there is not that much space. The electricity and sewage system and the water, it's very difficult situation, but these people are still living in the refugee camps. Under international law, all refugees have the right to return to their homes, but Israel has never implemented this right. And many people say, yeah, but there is not enough space for these Palestinian refugees to return. The situation has changed now and you can't let all these refugees back. Well, the situation is that like this. If you find out tonight, while you open the photo album, that actually your grandmother was wearing the Star of David, and you start to figure out that you're actually Jewish, you can go tomorrow to Amsterdam, or maybe after tomorrow or the day after, because now it's closed, and you can go to an organization that's called the Jewish Agency, and you can say, I'm Jewish, and you can return to Israel next week. And they will give you a passport, they will help you to find a job, they will help you to find a house, and they will give you money. Which means that if you are Jewish, you are allowed to go to Israel and there is space for you. But if you are a Palestinian and your family lived 60 years ago in Palestine, you are not allowed to go back. And this is the racism that we want to highlight today, that there is people are being treated in a different way because of their nature. So now we're getting to the area where our friends are from. If you look at this map, then you can see that, look at the map on the right. You can see that after Israel existed for almost 20 years, it decided to occupy more land, and it occupied the areas that are colored, which were the Golan Heights, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the Sinai of Egypt. But that has been later in an agreement been given back to Egypt. So we are stuck with the other three parts that are still until now under military occupation. It's not only so that there is a military presence in that area all the time. The other thing that happened is that what Israel started to allow is for Israeli citizens to move into the West Bank in what became known as settlements. I think that everybody heard of settlements, in Dutch Nederzettingen. All the blue dots that you see on this map are settlements. And this is, for example, what a settlement can look like. This is the settlement of Har Homa, which is very close from the houses of the Palestinians who are in our midst. This used to be a beautiful mountain full of pine trees. This was the area where they used to go picnicking and where they could, you know, take a breath and play football. And then, how long ago it was? 10, 15 years ago? Yeah, around 1996, this mountain was taken away. Like they cut down all the trees. They never paid anything to the people who owned the places. And they started to build this settlement. It is a Jewish-only settlement. It's on Palestinian land, but it's only meant for Jewish people. It means that now Ramzi and Yasmin, they cannot go to this area anymore. You see in the front of the photo, you can see a military road. The whole city is surrounded with a military road. There is electric barbed wire. It is impossible. If you come close to it, you could be shot. And this is not the only one. I showed you the map before with the blue dots. There are more than 500,000 Israeli citizens living in the West Bank now. And this is, according to international law, forbidden. If we decide to occupy Belgium tomorrow, which is under international law, we could, if we started to have a conflict with Belgium, we can occupy it for a while. It always has to have like a limited time. But we are not allowed to go and live in Belgium. We are not allowed to live in the occupied areas. That's under international law. So this is something that is absolutely illegal. And this is a map of the West Bank today. All the small triangles are the Israeli settlements. All the blue lines are the special roads that have been built to connect these settlements. So a Jewish person can come from Jerusalem or from Tel Aviv and drive over one of these roads, passing by the Palestinian villages, not going through them. going directly to their settlement, which might be really in the middle or in the, somewhere in the center of the West Bank, without noticing any Palestinians. The first time when I went to Israel, I drove to the Dead Sea. I will show you on the map. And I arrived to the Dead Sea and I came home and I was looking on the map and I said to myself, I was in the Dead Sea and I came back to Jerusalem. And so I drove through the West Bank, but I haven't seen any Palestinian. I haven't noticed any military occupation. I haven't. Maybe they're just, you know, saying these things. It's not true. And then later, when I started to travel around in that area and living with the Palestinian community, I started to understand how it works. They are completely separating the Israeli citizens from the Palestinians. And if you don't open your eyes, and if you don't notice that that village that you see in the far distance has a mosque, then you don't know who's living there, and you will never get in touch because it's a completely separated region. In order to separate the Palestinians from the Israeli settlements, they have started to make checkpoints. And I would like to invite Yasmin to tell us a little bit about her personal experiences in that area and how did you used to live there. I don't know, maybe you want to walk around with it, yeah.
I think you've noticed that we had a checkpoint at the door. So the checkpoint is, what you saw is like the simplest checkpoint. For me, in my daily life, I had to go through 3 checkpoints every time I wanted to go to my university. Because I lived in Bethlehem with my family, and my university was somewhere near Ramallah, so I had to go through 3 checkpoints every time. Because I'm not a Palestinian, I'm a Palestinian, and I'm not allowed into Jerusalem, and I can't take the original road that connected Bethlehem to Ramallah, which would always take like 30 minutes. My grandfather told me that, of course. I've never took that route. So it would take like 30 minutes to go from Bethlehem to Ramallah if you're going through Jerusalem. But for me, because I'm not allowed into Jerusalem, I had to go from Bethlehem and all the way around back to Ramallah. So if I'm lucky, it would take me like an hour and a half. And if I got stuck on the checkpoint, it would take me like, sometimes, as maximum, it took me 4 hours just to go to school. So I missed exams and I missed lectures. And I got frustrated a lot for a long time because I had to go pass through 3 checkpoints every day. The blue lines are only for settlers or for Israeli citizens. We're not allowed in. And this is what we call a jidar. This is the wall. This is an 8-meter high concrete wall that's surrounding the whole West Bank and Gaza Strip. This is like our usual view that we see. You when you're going around like in the Netherlands or anywhere in Europe, the only thing that you would see is like green miles of trees and water and rivers, but this is our view. This is the wall. The wall goes through. Okay. The wall is, you can see it is the red path that's going like zigzag around the West Bank. And if you can see, the green line here is the line agreed on by the United Nations to separate Palestine from Israel. And you can see, it is shown obviously that the wall goes into the Palestinian land. And it takes more land and more water resources into Israel. So basically, if someone lives here, he's trapped because you're not allowed into the Israeli side. And if you want to go into the West Bank, you have to pass through several checkpoints. So yeah, a friend of mine is pregnant, and she lives in a village nearby, which is like in the trapped area between the green and the red lines. And for her, it's almost impossible to get out of the area and go to give birth because an ambulance is never allowed to get in. So she moved out 2 months before she had to give birth. She moved out into the West Bank so she could give birth and without dangers and without someone telling her you're not allowed out to give birth. Actually, lots of women have given birth on the checkpoints. And you can see clearly that the wall goes like zigzag, it's not straight. It's like 750 meters long. Kilometers, yes, I'm sorry. And basically you can see from the picture that's separating Palestinian houses from each other. So there's the wall is passing through the village, and if you have a family at the other side of the wall, you basically can't really see them. And if you wanna, if you have school at the other side, if you want to get medicine, if you wanna get help, if you wanna have your normal life, you can't because the wall is just separating the village. Yeah, we didn't arrest anyone today at the checkpoint. But basically, some people would get arrested, or at some point you will just be waiting for a long time until your turn gets in. And sometimes it'll be raining, it'll be sunny, and you'll be just have to wait. You'll have to wait until their mood allows you to go, or I don't know. It's not logical. Yeah. Well, have you heard of administrative detention? No. Yeah. Okay. Okay, two of you. Well, administrative detention is basically they would come and arrest you. They would say that the reason for arresting you is a secret, and for security reasons, they can't tell you why you're arrested. So you'll be arrested for 6 months, and when it's time for you to get out, and you're at the last day of the 6 months. They will come and tell you, no, stop, you're not getting out today. You're going to be here for another 6 months. And if my father stayed in administrative detention for 3 years, and he didn't really know why. And every time the six months ended and he wanted to get out, they told him, no, you're going to stay for longer, and he stayed for 3 years. Well, yeah, they always arrest children. Like two weeks ago, a 6-year-old child threw a stone at a military jeep, Israeli jeep, and he was arrested. And he's 6 years old. So there are basically lots of children who are between the ages of 10 and 12 who are Israeli prisoners. And there are no court that would get them out because they are children or something. But they are considered as political prisoners in Israel. Well, I don't hate Jews. I don't think Ramzi or Nal or any Palestinian hate Jews because our problem is not with Jews. I come from a Christian family and my best friend is a Muslim. And it's not about religion. It's mainly about land. So basically, when you are living in your own land, you can see it like this. You are in your own house and with your family and your friends, and suddenly just someone comes in and kicks you out. And with no reason, he will tell you no reason. He just kicks you out and takes over everything. And he will tell you you're not allowed into your house anymore. So you are trapped outside your house. You can't get in. What would you do? Would you tell him, I would give you my car too? No one would ever do that. You would go to court, you would go to the police, you would get the whole community to know. You would want them to know what's really going on so that they can help you. So that's basically what I feel towards Israelis. Because they took over my land, they took over my home, and I can't just forgive them. Maybe at some point I will forgive, but I will not forget.
When I speak on the mic, or are you scared from the terrorist Palestinian? Well, first I just want to thank again. Crystal gave a very good background, historical background of the situation. Also Yasmin gave a nice personal aspect to it. But I think like listening to Crystal giving the facts, which are just like listening to a story of what happened exactly as like you would learn in a historical book, and then listening to Yasmin, who's telling the story with such a strength, like she's telling you her dad was in detention for 3 years, and she's just saying, yeah, he was in detention and he was waiting for them to get him out. And you don't see any kind of reaction that she's sad or that she's devastated or she's been affected by what happened. And I'm not saying that she's not, I'm just saying that maybe it's something that people who live under oppression try to cope with by it starts to defining them, their personalities. And this is what you would almost see in most Palestinians, who every Palestinian actually is facing an oppression on a daily life. And what's happening is that it's becoming a normal situation. So a Palestinian who was born in the 80s or 90s, they don't know anything but that they are being occupied by the Israelis. I was born in 82, and that's all that I've seen, that there are always people who are checking me whenever I'm moving from one place to the other. I know that it's not easy for me just to think I want to travel. I need to go through a lot of procedures and also checkpoints, and also I have a big issue of not being sure that I will be given a visa to go one place to the other or the other. But also, I started noticing things one step at a time. So yes, as a child, you just see those things. I moved from Jordan to Palestine, and I go through the borders in Jericho, where you go and everyone is being checked thoroughly. As a child, an 8 or 9 years, you have to strip in front of a soldier. So that they would see you don't have, I don't know what, weapons, or maybe not, because I believe it's just an act to prove or to show you that you are being controlled by others, that you are oppressed, that there are people who should be controlling you, and you do not have the right to be moving freely. So you do not grow in situations where people in different countries or different places grow up with, knowing that it's your right to travel freely, it's your right to speak up against oppression. And not that Palestinians didn't, they did speak up against oppression, and that's what we saw since the beginning, since 1948 and even before. There were movements against this Zionist project of coming and stealing the land, and the movements and the resistance changed, and it is still keeping changing. It has different forms. At the same time of having violent, there is also non-violent. Mostly, it's non-violent. What you hear in the media is mostly the violent, because that's what makes it up to the media. But the civil and non-violent resistance among the Palestinian people and the Palestinian history has been it's entrenched into the history of how they're fighting against the Israeli occupation. And occupation here, it's not just a word. It means that, as you have seen, land has been stolen. You are suddenly, you were living in your house, planning for your future, and the next thing, next morning, you're on the run. You're a refugee. You don't have a house. You don't know. You don't own anything. Many people, as you've seen, were inside the West Bank and Gaza, or in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, living in tents, and then they built up houses. But also others have left to Europe, the Americas, and other places. And they have built lives outside. But there is still resistance everywhere. They're still connected and trying to get back, like to get the rights of the human rights of the Palestinians. So in general, what I wanted to say is that during all these 60 years, we hear it as historical fact, but it's actual personal lives that you go through every day. That you go to school not normally, because you don't know that sometimes you would have school or not, because there could be a protest, there could be an invasion, there could be someone who's being killed by soldiers. So that's an everyday life. If you're giving birth, as Yasmin was saying, you go to the checkpoint. Sometimes you're lucky to pass. Sometimes you're lucky to give birth at the checkpoint. But many times you're not lucky because you're not in a proper situation of giving birth as pregnant women. And many have died as women or as the born or unborn child. And there are many documented cases of this happening. There's also like one of the most important aspects that we see oppression in Palestine is when it becomes economical, when the Israeli occupation and oppression fights your source of income. And mostly Palestinians, they depend a lot on farming and olive tree, as Crystal will talk later about the olive tree campaign, and that's how she got into Palestine to start with. Many lands have been confiscated by the Israeli occupation, and those lands are what many Palestinian families depend on for their livings, from the products of the olive tree, which is like, for Palestinians, an olive tree is called a holy tree because you get the olives from that you can eat, sell, making olive oil also to sell. And also the olive wood, which is being used for handicrafts. Handicrafts for either figures, or they can be made, like you can make different kinds of home tools or decoration for kitchen or for decoration. And yeah, many people depend on that. But also, it's not just about olive trees. Olive trees is mainly the symbol that we use, but there are different kinds of trees. In general, if you take out lands of people, then it's very limited for them to depend economically. How can they live? How can they produce income? Of course, now, with the new economical system and the virtual world that we're living in, there's new ways of making income, but it's still not easy for Palestinians because as well, you have still to apply for special permission for exports, for example. You have to apply for special permission, and that should be given from an occupying power, not from a democratically elected government that represents the people. So that what the Israeli state, as an occupying state, does. And I don't want to go into different points, but I just wanted to comment on one other point. When talking about anti-Semitic, or talking about what do you feel about the Jews, I mean, I think the whole question is troubling. What do you think about the Jews? What do you think about the Christians? What do you think about the Gypsies? What do you think about, when you ask about minorities, or when you ask about ethnicities and how do you feel towards them, I think even to start with asking such a question is having some kind of excluding or otherization of other people. Like, there are Jews and there are non-Jews. They're all people. Yes, we have different ethnicities. We have different backgrounds, and we have different cultures. And there are so many things that make a person unique or a group of people different than the others. And in no way this should create any discrimination from between groups. So if you ask my personal opinion, I don't give any, like, it doesn't really matter to me what you believe in. It does matter if we're going to have a discussion about it. But that would be a debate that we can have. But for me, how do I feel about you, or how I would... How I would deal with you or react with you, this has nothing to do with what your family origins are. But I'm not saying that there is not anti-Semitism in the world. There is, and you find it everywhere, not just in Europe or in America or in Arab countries or in Asian countries or African countries. You find it everywhere. But it's not, when we talk about Israel, Palestine, and this history, this is not part of the story. Anti-Semitic is part of another story that happened in Europe with the Jews. What's happening in Palestine is another story of discrimination and racism, but it doesn't have to do anything with Semitism, because Arabs are also Semitic. So they cannot be anti-Semitic, like, if we're gonna talk about that. But when you are oppressed, when you are living a difficult life, and when your relatives are being killed for no reason or put in prison for years, then you cannot help but develop such aggressive feelings towards the oppression, the oppressing system that you are facing. And this is represented by soldiers with weapons, and those are people. So unconsciously, yes, there are some uncomfortable and hating feelings, that it's not easy if you're seeing families being killed. Like, there have been villages that were wiped off from the map, people being totally killed, refugee camps in Lebanon and other places where children, women, men, everyone killed. So when you see such bloody events and you relate to such people, then you cannot not react on it or have emotional reaction to such events. And then you will find something to blame it on. And yes, many Palestinians or Arabs blame the Israelis, but actually I think Arabs or Palestinians, they blame themselves even more for not being able to act strongly or stop this. But later you discover that you are such a small thing against this big machinery of occupation that's coming to kill you. It's a big, like, system that you cannot, as individual, fight. And that's why I think we're gonna go to the conversation now of Palestinian people are reaching out for international solidarity, and it's been happening. This way, you're trying to get other people to help you from other places in the world that would come. Who believe in human rights in general, who believe in your rights to be equal as any other person. And there are different ways. I don't know now if we're going to go into that. Maybe you will have an introduction into it, or maybe you should talk a little bit about BDS, and then I can continue. Okay, so this is part of my favorite point of the talk, because I talk here about my the place, let me start, the place that I grew up in, it's called Beit Sahur. I don't know, I saw Yasmin going out, I don't know if she's being emotional about it or not. Okay. So just forget that. But anyway, to go back about Beit Sahur, I think it would be nice for her to listen to that because she's also from the same town. I call it city. It's not a city. It's a very small town, village, but it has a municipality. And I always tell people that I cannot say that it's not a city because my grandfather, who's the father of my mother, it was in his time when he was the mayor of the city that it was recognized as a city, or it was given a city recognition. So for my mother's sake, I wouldn't say that it's not a city. But it is a village. It's a very small village. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing Beit Sahur to the discussion is because Beit Sahur is one of the places that have actually witnessed a strong civil resistance. And that was very apparent during the First Intifada. Because in the First Intifada, the situation in the West Bank, it's a city in the West Bank or a village in the West Bank that is next to Bethlehem. Bethlehem city is composed from three main cities and many villages, Bethlehem, Beit Jala, and Beit Sahur. Beit Sahur is the prettiest, of course. So at that time, in the 80s, end of the 80s, Palestine was under the Israeli, or sorry, the West Bank was under the Israeli administration. So there was no Palestinian representation politically, yes, there were parties, but not on a governmental administrative form. So it was all administered by Israel. And the problem was is that Palestinians were not given full citizenship. They were Palestinians living under Israeli administration, but they are not represented in any parliament or congress. So you cannot ask for your rights politically or democratically in the state of Israel, because there was no state of Palestine. Until now, there is no state of Palestine, not declared at least. There was a civil resistance against this Israeli administration. And the logo was that... I forgot the logo. No taxation, exactly, thank you. No taxation without representation. So people from Beit Sahur started this movement that we're not going to pay taxes for the Israeli government because we're not being represented. Also, we're not receiving the same services as other citizens in Israel or other cities in Israel. So they started by not paying taxes, and it was a big a movement, and Israel then started feeling the pressure of this, because it's a civil resistance. It's portraying a different image about the Palestinians, that they can have such a civil mind and thinking of different ways of resisting. So it disturbs the image that the Israeli state was trying to portray, and they've succeeded in portraying about Palestinians being terrorists, being of no educational background, being coming from tents, living still with camels, but that was not the truth. And then this resistance started making it to the media. And the people of Beit Sahur started with this project of trying to be economically independent on themselves. So not buying things from Israel and totally depending on themselves, growing their own vegetables, exchanging things inside the city. And I want to go into the story of the cows because that's a long story, but there were also, because the milk was the major problem, that Israel controlled that. And yes, you can grow vegetables and exchange it, but milk was such an important product. So there was a group of activists in Beit Sahur that brought some cows to produce milk, and they were harassed by the Israelis all the time. And there was also another act of the Palestinians, the Beit Sahurians, such a strong act of agency when they went out to the municipality, which was represented a representation of the Israeli administration, and they have thrown their IDs on the ground. All the citizens of the city, they said, no, we are not gonna follow your oppression, you are not representing us, and this ID is not our ID. Because an ID in Palestine is a very important issue. If you are in Gaza, if you are in Jerusalem, if you are in the West Bank, or you are a Palestinian living inside Israel, each group has a different kind of ID. And that's one side. Then you have the refugees who have another kind of categorization. At that time, the Beit Sahurians, they went and they've thrown it and they said no to your occupation. And that was a civil resistance. Things changed, of course. There was a peace settlement, and then the peace settlement did not work well because it was not based on well grounds. It has ignored many issues that were important for the Palestinians. It has ignored human rights for the Palestinians. It was put on the side. A solution was made that was not a complete solution, so it failed. And violence started again. And it was a natural progress, a natural development that a violence would start after facing such a violence oppression from Israeli soldiers. And then there was the Second Intifada, and that was the highest violent resistance Palestine witnessed. But later, and actually throughout the time, the whole time, the civil resistance was still there. And now it's getting even stronger. And now that's where we're going. In 2005, there was the call of Palestinians saying to internationals, this is our resistance and the oppression that we are facing, we choose how to resist it. And we are choosing now to resist this in a civil way. But in order to do that, we need the help of, we need an international solidarity with us. If you believe that everyone should be equal, then we do need your help. And that's when the boycott, divestment, and sanction campaign against the Israeli occupation started. And boycott is against the boycotting the Israeli products, and that includes economically, culturally, academically, and divestment from the companies that profit from Israeli projects or have projects that are done inside Israel, and the sanctions, which as people on the ground we cannot do much about. We can put pressure on governments, we can put pressure on different nationalities to put sanctions on Israel until we reach to the goals of the campaign, which are three, which are to end the occupation, the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land, and to give the refugees the right of return. And the third one is equality for all Palestinians, including Palestinians and non-Palestinians living inside Israel. And until we reach then, and we believe that BDS is such a strong movement that has actually paid off in South in former apartheid South Africa, and we are trying to use such a tool to end the illegal occupation in Palestine. And this needs an international solidarity. And so far it has been doing great, actually. It has paid off a lot. Many people, public speakers, artists, academics, has refused to go to Israel to perform or to give a lecture. The boycott campaign is being all over the world, and Crystal will give you more of what's happening in the Netherlands and in Europe of this campaign. But it is getting a lot of attention, and it is getting on the nerves of the Israeli government and the Israeli state. And we believe by such a movement that is strong, we can make change. And if everyone of you would start acting on it, then it will definitely make a change. And that's what we're asking for. If you believe in human rights, if you believe in equality, if you believe ending oppression in the world, then we should start acting on it. Because we cannot wait for it. And this is one of the most effective tools that has been proven historically, and we're asking everyone to act on it.
I don't want to make it very long, but I do want to get into a more practical part of the to end with. I want to add to what Ramzi said, because when we speak about boycott, I often see people, they're a little bit like, okay, boycott, that sounds like very negative. And especially older people, they are afraid that it's like, don't buy from Jews. You know, like the old idea that we know from the Second World War. It's not like this. The boycott is not a call for boycotting Israeli individuals. I have a near where I live, there is an Israeli shopkeeper, and I always do my shopping there. I'm not boycotting the man, and I'm not going to boycott any person. The boycott is about campaigns where you do not invest or spend your money on companies that profit from the occupation. And boycott is a very legitimate and very non-violent way to resist. It worked in South Africa. And the people who were active during South Africa apartheid, they say it took us 20 years before we started to see some results. The movement of BDS for Palestine is 6 years old now, and we are already seeing much more results than they ever had in the first 20 years of the South Africa apartheid boycott. This is also because of the new media, because it's much easier to spread the word. If you now go to the websites, you can easily find out what campaigns are running, which products we are talking about. And one thing that we have noticed is that campaigning is not only about seriously thinking that you can really affect the Israeli economy, it's more about awareness raising, the fact that you talk about it, and in the other hand, it's kind of, isolating Israel, saying that as long as you do not comply with international law, as long as you're behaving in a bad way, we're not going to deal with you in a normal way. It's like when I was a teacher, if I had a kid in the class who was always annoying, and I would always be saying, now you really have to keep your mouth shut. No, now really I want you if you do that again, I'm going to put you out of the classroom. But if I never would punish him, then he will think that he's the boss, and then he will laugh in my face. And I think this is the same thing, that for 60 years we have seen that Israel is not keeping to any United Nations resolution. They are not complying with international law. So we can keep waiting and thinking that the peace process and talking and conversations will help, but they will probably not. So we'll have to kind of is something going on? Everybody's staring at the screen. Like, I see all your eyes, like, ooh. Yeah, I am paying attention. So I do think that we can actually do something, which is to follow the BDS call and is joining these campaigns. There is a website. I don't now have to tell you everything, because I think that you are going to forget it. I would like to ask you to either go to the website called bdsnederland.nl or leave your email address and I will send you the link. If you already know that you're going to forget the link but that you are interested to know a little bit more, then you can just leave your email address. I will not use it for anything else than just send you once an email with two or three interesting links, and then I will delete your email address. It stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions. For example, a very practical example. If you go to any supermarket in Holland, you would find that many of the vegetables are actually from Israel. It says that they are Israeli products. We're talking about avocados, mangoes, sometimes potatoes, dates, certain spices and... oranges, Jaffa oranges. Many of these fruits and vegetables are not even produced in Israel proper. They are produced in the settlements, on stolen land with stolen water. And that's why these vegetables and fruits are so cheap. Because the people who are growing them do not pay for the water and they do not pay for the land. So it is and there is a special agreement between Israel and the European Union. It's called the Association Treaty, which makes that Israel does not have to pay taxes. Even they are not part of the European Union, they do not have to pay the taxes that all the other countries in the world who are not EU have to pay. That means that their vegetables and fruits are much cheaper than from other countries outside of the EU. And then if you are in the supermarket, it will not tell you if this is a product from Israel or if it's from the West Bank, if it's from a settlement. And if you ask, I always ask them, like, do you really know where this is from? Then usually they don't know. So you cannot, if you want to make a conscious decision about, if you buy fair trade, if you buy organic stuff, if you are like very conscious about what you buy, you do not want to spend your money on an illegal occupation. But if you can't even make that decision because it's not clear, then you have to basically boycott all the products from Israel, because otherwise you don't know where your money is going. So we're talking about also Tival. I don't know if you know in Albert Heijn that all the vegetarian products from Tival are by an Israeli company that is now collaborating with Albert Heijn. And it now says that Tival comes from Zaandam. But this is an Israeli company and they are profiting from your money if you are buying their vegetarian products. The same with the hummus from the brand Sabra. It's very nice, and they have very nice baba ghanoush also, but it's also a company that is in a settlement in the West Bank. So when you eat your bread with hummus, your money went to this company, and this company is profiting from the occupation. And as long as people profit from the situation there, they are not going to be willing to change anything. And this is what we hear now slowly from our Israeli activists, because we have a group called the Boycott From Within. Those are Israeli people, like the Anarchists Against the Wall, the people from the Alternative Information Center, the women's groups. They are Israelis and they say, yes, you have to boycott these products. Because our country, our society is not going to love the Palestinians all of a sudden. They're not going to change anything unless we are starting to feel isolated, unless we are going to start to feel that the world is watching us, and when we start to feel it in our pockets. So there is a bigger growing group of activists from within Israel who are supportive of this. There is a website called whoprofits.org. It's very simple. You go to that website, you type in the name of a company or of a brand name, and you can find out if it was from an Israeli settlement. And in this way, you can very easily know where your money is going. So, and this is something that Israelis are doing. It's not something that Palestinians are doing. I want to mention another product in Holland. Maybe maybe you don't even you have never even heard of it, but it's they're trying to be more established here. It's the Dead Sea skincare product by a brand called Ahava. Ahava is Hebrew and means love, and they started a campaign against this product, and they say there is no love in occupation. And the campaign is actually called the Stolen Beauty Campaign, because Ahava takes mud from the Dead Sea, but as you can see on the map, the can you see on the map the Dead Sea? Yeah, there where Bethlehem is on the right. Like two-thirds of the Dead Sea are part of the West Bank. And also under international law, Israel does not have the right to use the natural resources from occupied territory. So they're taking the mud from there, they are producing in a settlement, and then they're selling here these beauty products to make your skin shiny and to make your skin soft. In Holland, we started with a group of girls to protest. Actually, they started in the United States. They had a group called the Bikini Brigade. And that was a group of girls. They went in pink bikinis to the stores and they put mud on their skins and they said, there is no love in occupation. This is stolen beauty. And that's a campaign. When you're building a campaign and you're going on the street several times and you're getting people to know about it. In Holland, we wanted to do the same, but we thought, yeah, bikinis. It's kind of cold here. And also, we're not really comfortable in bikinis. So we started the bathrobes brigades. So we have our white bathrobes and then we have pink towels on our heads and we go into the streets. And in Holland, I think that people who are from here, they know, you know, that if you want to protest something, or maybe you don't know and you should maybe learn, in Holland, if you protest, then you start shouting and screaming and you have banners and you're then people will not listen to you because they're like, you know, go to work. Go wash yourself, you know, these things. I'm sure that all of us have heard them before. And people will not listen. They will think that, yeah, you're different from me. I don't believe what you say. But if you approach them in the way that they think, and you say, like, do you use makeup that is tested on animals? No, that's bad. Do you like fair trade products? Yeah, it's very good. And organic? Yeah, it's very good. Would you spend your money on a company that profits from an occupation? No, that's bad. Then don't buy this product. And then we give them the Ahava sticker or the Ahava flyer. And that's when they start to realize, oh, thank you, they actually tell us. Thank you for informing us and we will not buy this anymore. And because we look funny with the bathrobes, so we are approachable and we speak with people. We even made some songs, like around the Christmas time, we made some songs about Ahava that... Sinterklaas kapoentje, geen Ahava in mijn schoentje. You know, people are like, oh, they're singing. Oh, what are they singing? And then they are more interested. So this is the campaigns that we have started and they've been really in a more positive way. And I could talk for hours, I will not. But I think that if you feel that you would like to do something related to Palestine, that I can mention these three things. It's the boycott website, bdsnederland.nl, the olive tree campaign that plants olive trees in Palestine, and you can all sponsor an olive tree. You will get a beautiful certificate at home says that you sponsored the tree. You can also give the certificate to somebody else. Like when my sister's babies were born, I would give them an olive tree that will grow up with them, and hopefully when they are 20, 25, they'll come with me and visit their trees in Palestine. And this way also other people get to know about these projects. And then the third one thing I want to mention is that in 2 weeks from now, there will be another humanitarian aid flotilla leaving to the Gaza Strip. Maybe you remember that last year there were a couple of boats that were attacked by the Israeli army and then 13 people were killed. This year they're going with 20 boats. There will be a couple of really high profile people and well-known people on board, also Jewish people, Israelis. From Holland, there will be a boat shared with an Italian group, and there will be about 10-15 Dutch people going on the boat, some journalists. The boat is leaving in the weekend of the 25th, 26th of June, so by the end of this month. They have a website called NederlandGaza.nl. You can check the site. And in that weekend in Utrecht, we're going to have a supportive mini flotilla in the old canal in Utrecht. because we want to tell the Israelis that we're watching them and that they cannot attack this flotilla. It's a humanitarian flotilla. It's not meant to harm the security of Israel. It's not going to bring weapons. It's just going to bring food and construction materials that are useful in the Gaza Strip. Yeah, I can already, I saw it. So if you are in Utrecht by chance, or if you're interested, then when you leave your email address, you can make a note that I would like to join the flotilla, so I can give you more detailed information on where to meet, and then you can join us. The idea is to go through the canals in Utrecht with a couple of boats, to have Palestinian flags and balloons. And I'm desperately looking for musicians. If you know of any samba band or music marching band or a person who plays a trumpet or an accordion, because all the people we've asked until now, they are not available. So if you have any connections, then let us know, because we want this flotilla to have a positive atmosphere, so that people would support it. Okay. Yeah, I have his email address somewhere. Are there any questions for either Yasmin or Ramzi or me? You
I have a question for you about the boycott. I have some stickers that say that barcodes ending with 729. Those are Israeli products.
Yeah, barcodes are something that companies can buy, and usually if you buy a barcode from Israel, it starts with 729, which is an indication that it's an Israeli product, but it doesn't mean that because there are also products that do not have that barcode, but they'll have another, like an American barcode, because they bought it from outside. But it's true that Israeli barcode is 729, yeah. So you,
it's
if you,
certain guide, you also have to check.
So we have on our website, we have the most important products listed that you can find. On the other hand, if you as an individual boycott something, it's good. I mean, it's your personal choice, but doesn't really make that much sense. It's better to join like campaigns where you say, for example, we in Holland, we have a company called Rival. It's from Dordrecht. They have been literally sending cranes to build the separation wall between the West Bank villages. This is something you can campaign on. You can actually do a campaign against Rival. The same thing is now, I don't know if you know, but in Amsterdam, in the northern part of Amsterdam, the municipality actually bought Egged buses, which are buses from an Israeli bus company that also ride in the settlements. This is something that you could make a campaign as people from Amsterdam, and you can, you can make a checkpoint in front of the Egged buses and put attention to the fact that they are using buses from Israel and therefore spending their money and promoting that. Yeah.
Can I quickly say, it almost seems like you meant that like you shouldn't boycott products, but just like join a campaign, because as an individual you can't do anything, but like it should work like in two ways. I suppose like if you boycott products and join a campaign, that would be better. But
that's what I mean.
Like you shouldn't boycott products.
No, it's for everybody. Of course, it's an individual choice, and I do think that you should make that like decision. But it's more useful to do it in a campaign's form. So if you do it, like if you do it and you go, if you have a supermarket that you go to regularly and you see that they are selling these Israeli products, don't just not buy it, but go to the dude of the supermarket and tell him, hey, I saw that you're selling these Israeli products. Did you realize that you are selling products that are possibly from settlements? And I prefer if you would have avocados from Peru or wherever they come from, because I can't buy these avocados because it goes against my conscience. And I noticed that it recently when I say it to supermarkets, they're like, ah, you're the so manyest person who told me this. Really. So the more this thing is alive, the more they will choose for other products from other countries. And I will repeat, this boycott is until Israel complies with international law. When they start to behave normal, we don't have to boycott anymore. So this is really something just to urge them to accept the international law.
Sephardic Jews, and they believe for them the Holy Land is somewhere else. And there's a lot of Orthodox Jews, and they just don't believe in living in Israel, because Israel is the promised land, but it's not promised to live in. And a lot of people in their minds, they've got that affiliation of Israel and Judaism, but it's not. The land was maybe sacred, but it's not sacred only if you live in it.
We absolutely know of a lot of Jewish people all over the world who are not Zionists and who do not believe that they should be in Israel, and especially they believe that they should not be occupying other people and taking other people's lands. We have in Holland, we have a group called Another Jewish Voice, an Ander Joods Geluid, for example. There's a man, you should try to read something from him or find him on YouTube. His name is Hayo Meyer. He survived the Holocaust. He spent two years in Auschwitz. He survived it as one of the few people. This is a very old man now. So if you still have the chance to meet him, because he gives lectures sometimes, you should. He's really interesting. He showed my another Palestinian friend of mine who came over. He showed him the tattoo of the concentration camp on his arm, and then he told him the Palestinians are the Jews of today. And this, my friend told me, this is the first time somebody ever dared to say something like this to me. And this is a Jewish man who survived the Holocaust. And it was very touching. This is the first time I actually can talk about it without becoming emotional, because I told the story a couple of times now. But yeah, there are many Jewish people who disagree with what's going on. Absolutely, yeah.
The West Bank was occupied by Jordan from the First World War till the occupation by the Israelis. What would Palestinians here consider themselves Palestinian and not Jordanian? And also, what was the level of resistance from the Palestinians against Jordanian occupation?
Just to get your question right, you're asking what if Palestine was, or you're asking about the time when it was under the Jordanian administration, and how did they feel about it?
Why do you consider yourself Palestinians and not Jordanian?
Well, in that time, anyway, it was a periodical time, and it was, I'm not finding the word, but it's like a period where you're waiting until there would be a declaration of a Palestinian state later on. But it was under the West Bank was under the Jordanian administration, and Gaza was under the Egyptian administration. And in that time, there were movements happening in different countries in the Middle East by Palestinians, political Palestinian groups or parties, to liberate Palestine. So even if it was under the Jordanian administration, Jordan stepped in because there was nothing else. So it was an agreement that they will take over as an administration. And I mean, Jordan itself is made of mostly Palestinians. 60% would be from Palestinian origins. The feeling does not change. If there's an occupation, it doesn't change where it's coming from. If there's an oppression, it doesn't matter whether your cousin is oppressing you or your neighbor. So whether it's Jordan, whether it's Israel, whether it's China, the States, whoever, it's an oppression. So you're asking someone who's under oppression, what do you think if you would change your oppressor from blue to red? It's the same. So yeah, I don't know if I answered your question. Was that satisfying?
From the Israeli occupation onwards. much about if the Palestinians were resisting the Jordanians in the same way that they were resisting the Israelis.
Okay. Yeah, well, the Jordanians were not occupying the land forcefully. As I said, it was a period where Jordan stepped in to administratively organize or take over the country until a solution would be made. But that was this solution was, or it wasn't a solution. This period, it came after the Israeli occupation, 1948. And that's when the Israeli occupation started. In 67, yes, that's the later occupation, or what we, like the form of it that we see right now. But at that time, just to answer your question briefly, there was no resistance against Jordan as an occupier, because it was not. But if it had stayed, it would have, because at the end of it, anyway, there were resistance against the Jordanian government or form, and some events, black history, happened with the Jordanian administration. We'll take that.
It's interesting, the picture that you showed of the settler holding up the Torah as a sort of claim to land ownership, and Palestinian having more conventional claim to land, having a documentation. Within the Israeli state, once the settlers have taken land, do they then have any sort of official recognition which is documented by the Israeli state that they have that land?
The Israelis, if
the
they
settlers,
had...
The settlers, after the time, did the settlers have any written documentation given to them, recognized by the Israeli state, that they now have that land?
The land that is in the West Bank, where settlements are built on, mostly the government builds these housing projects, and they give incentives for settlers to go and live in them. So, like, you pay less taxes. Sometimes it's offered for free of rent. You are being given some kind of document that you are living there. But within international law, it doesn't work. But also, it's different from one settlement to the other. These are like the form that I talked about is the form of new settlements. There are settlements like in Hebron, where it is within the city of like the Palestinian city. Inside the old city, you have settlers like on the upper floor, it's where Israeli settlers live. On the first floor, the ground floor, you have Palestinians living. And that is like a total messed up situation. They have, some of them, have papers that are claimed to be it's claimed by the Palestinians that they are forged, those papers, that they own the land, or that they have bought it from the original owner, a Palestinian. In most cases, it did not. These are not real documents. They were taken illegally. There was a question here.
I just wanted to be asking what you said about Jordan. Jordan is an authoritarian country that was created after World War II by the English. It's ruled by an ethnic minority, and the majority of people there are either Bedouin or Palestinians. Hundreds of Palestinians were massacred in Jordan, and to this Zionist notion where Palestinians are actually Jordanian is use of politics to claim that there is no Palestinian nationality. And that's I'm not saying what you're suggesting, but it sounds to me like this very usual notion where Palestinians should see themselves as Jordanian, but there's no relation to that. But the small ethnic minority that rules Jordan has nothing to do with the Palestinian history.
That's completely different to the question I was asking.
it's not related to what
it's
you asked,
relevant,
but
so.
Yeah, I have a question there, right?
I was wondering if the mention about land, the occupied land, if there was a mention, if there was a Israeli archive of pieces of land that were settled after a certain date, because in peace negotiations that would make it easy in the outswap of land, because then they would say, well, after this date we took these pieces of land, and before that date these borders existed. So you can get these pieces of land back, and this is the border.
Yes, but where would you get this information from? The Israeli documentation. Yes, there are documentations, I believe. And Crystal mentioned an Israeli historian who made a big research about this, Ilan Pape, of how the land, of how the planned Dalit of the Zionist movement when they came into Palestine in the 20s and even before in the end of the 19th century. There are documents, but again, those documents mostly mean nothing because there are people who were forced out of their houses and lands, and many of them did not take documents to prove. If you are fleeing, someone is coming to throw you out, then you don't take documents. So there would be many undocumented rights for if we would go into that. But there are other proofs that they were there, archaeological, or by witnesses, by history. So there is a proof. But we leave the negotiation aside because it hasn't proven anything so far. I do want to mention just one thing before I go. Just for promotion of another workshop that's going to happen next week, because I forgot when I was talking about the BDS, there is like within the Palestinian community, there are also within there, there are different communities and there are different people who are supporting the BDS, and we are like trying to reach the different international communities to support the BDS. And inside Palestine, there has been now in the last year a new movement called Palestinian Queer for BDS. And Palestinian Queer for BDS, it's the queer community in Palestine that is trying to politically be there in the Palestinian arena and trying to tell the world that as Israel has been branding itself as the only democracy in the world, as the queer or gay haven in the Middle East, not in the world, sorry, the only democracy in the Middle East, I missed, that this kind of branding, it's actually, if you would, there's a new term that is being used, it's called pink washing, the image of Israel, which is coming from whitewashing their crimes by showing a different image. And as they have shown Palestinians as being violent in the history, and now they're trying to show themselves as being more protectors of human rights, which is based on false statements and false facts. And the Palestinian queers were used by the Israelis to sell the argument that Palestinian queers are being persecuted inside Palestine. They come to Israel, it's not the same. Israel is a place where human rights are being respected. And this is a whole kind of rebranding of Israel, or lifting the attention of the world from the crimes that are being committed by the Israeli occupation, by the Israeli army, illegal army in Palestine, And they're covering that by spreading other images, pink images. And you see many campaigns of gay tourism in Israel, where you would see soldiers as gay soldiers and like saying, come and meet our hot gay soldiers in Israel, they will welcome you. And this is trying to reach to different communities, different niches in the world to spread this image, which is totally false, which is also, it's not right towards the Palestinians that are being oppressed on a daily basis. So Palestinian Queer for BDS has started last year, and they're trying to spread the word, and they're trying to support a BDS movement because they believe as a group that by BDS we can make a change. They are coming here next week. They're coming to Amsterdam. So if any one of you is available, there's going to be a weekend called Queeristan 2011. It's going to be in a squat in Amsterdam called Schijnheilig. Did I pronounce it right? So 17th, 18th, 19th, PQBDS would be representing the opening lecture on the 17th, and there would be a workshop about pinkwashing, homo nationalism, and gay tourism on Saturday. So I hope we will see you there. Also, there would be other events in Queeristan about racism, anti-racism, about gay women from different ethnicities, and about public action. It will be great, so hope to see you there. Small promotion.
Yeah, thanks for being with us, and if you want to take any brochures or stickers, feel free. There's one brochure that describes our trips to Palestine, because if you want to visit Palestine, you can join one of our trips in October, December, or February, and you can get more information by just leaving your email address. Thank you.